negative?
Well, it's not between me and NBC.
No, no, I mean, but that, look, you know, you're an analyst. You watch these people. Is it your opinion that NBC News spins the war negative?
I think that the coverage of the war by NBC that I've really focused on, especially since I was in Iraq last month, to me, it seems bizarrely focused only on the IEDs, only on the latest reprisal killings that are taking place. When stories that are so fascinating and interesting and broader and human interest, stuff that Today Show and NBC likes to do, those stories are out there for anyone to get. So I don't get it.
Okay, well, I don't pretend to know what they do over there, but I have said on the record that I think NBC is the most anti-Bush network right now, more than ABC, CNN, and CBS.
Well, they seem invested right now. I mean, if I
I don't know if that's true, it just seems to be that way.
Talking about how you think that NBC is the most anti-Bush network on the air right now. NBC, which is owned by General Electric, which also owns General Electric Money, General Electric Industrial, Universal Studios, Universal Pictures, Universal Studios Hollywood and Theme Park, the Universal Studios Japan, Bravo Network, MSNBC, the Sci-Fi Channel, Telemundo International, the USA Network, Telemundo Puerto Rico. It has an annual revenue of over $150 billion. But these guys, who are firmly embedded within the Imperial War privatized monetary system, are anti-Bush. Please, this is anti-Bush and Marvin Slave Time Check. You're listening to 103.3. FreakRadio.org with Skid in Santa Cruz, Antelope Valley, 107.5 Free Radio Asheville, PropagandaPress.org, LUVER.com, The World, RadioForAll.net, The Universe. Check out the Slave Web, just go Slave Revolt Radio. blogspot.com. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to deal with an aspect of the making of a war society. We got all that and a hell of a lot more on 103.3 Slave Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers. Here we go again. And hello, especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
Barbaric acts at the U.S. Empire and its U.S. G.I. Joe jackboot soldiers are engaging in, and the draconian attacks on the basic rights of people on Sam's plantation are not loose cannon shots out of the bowels of the Empire, but a process of disciplining internally its population for endless war. A signaling also to the rest of the world that in defense of its empire and its imperial pillar of domination, the dollar, the petrodollar exchange currency, and the dollar as the world exchange currency, its military, Sam is willing and ready for worldwide war without end. In this Ruins of Empire segment, Dollars and Chains, Part 3, the restructuring of the America into a permanent war command society. We will get into just that. So first, let's start off with Jeremy Scahill, as he describes how the Democrats are complicit in this war-making apparatus, basically as administrators like their counterparts to the Republican Party, with the Republican Party as administrators for the ruling order. So let's check this out.
The extreme nature of the Bush administration and how horrible things have gotten in this country and the violence that we see unfolding before our eyes every day have opened a very rare window for us into the nature of empire in this country. And I think that some people are making a grand mistake by identifying the times in which we live with the man or the administration rather than the system and the bipartisan complicity that we've seen for so many decades in this country. And I think that one thing that we have to realize if we're about intellectual honesty is that there is a bipartisan aristocracy that has determined policy for far too long in this country. It's easy to oppose a war with a president like George W. Bush. Where were so many of those voices rising up now when Bill Clinton illegally bombed Yugoslavia for 78 days? Where were they when Bill Clinton was bombing Iraq an average of once every 3 days for the closing years of his presidency, when he initiated the longest sustained bombing campaigns since Vietnam in Iraq's so-called no-fly zone? That it's easy to be a vegetarian between meals, as so many Democrats and liberals are today. It's tough when the people that you voted for are the ones waging the war that you oppose deep down, and it's tough to muster up the intellectual and personal strength to come out and say, I'm against your war, Mr. Clinton. It's easy to be against George Bush's war because he's such an offensive individual. It's not that the Democrats have no spine. I'm tired of hearing people say, oh, the Democrats have no spine. It's much more insidious than that. They have a very firm spine. It's much more dark and more insidious. It's that the establishment of the Democratic Party, I'm not talking about the left of the Democratic Party that's on the fringe as far as officialdom is concerned. The center of the Democratic Party shares a common agenda with the Bush administration on the most pressing issues of our day, whether it's the occupation in Iraq or the Patriot Act, which 99 of those 100 senators voted in favor of. Only Russ Feingold of Wisconsin stood up and said no. The Democrats argue that they present an alternative to the policies of the Bush administration, and yet, in all of these years of Bush being in power, where have the Democrats gotten us with their loyal opposition? The Democrats say they present an alternative, and yet they allow Alito and Roberts to sail by and turn the Supreme Court into a fascist institution in this country, and I use that word meaning it. Not a single Democrat with any voice within the party has come forward with a clear call for an immediate and total withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, and this John Murtha business is one of the great hoodwinks of our time. John Murtha's program is a continued occupation program. The Democratic Party has presented no alternative to the madness of the Bush administration, and yet they have the audacity to say, vote for us in 2006, vote for us in 2008, and all they can muster up as a convincing line is, we're not Bush. Well, that's not enough anymore.
All right, so let's deal with some of this. In the dollar and change reality that we're in. Of course, the Democratic Party is not going to offer no real alternative because they're not an alternative. The quagmire that the U.S. empire finds itself in is one of mammoth proportions. It's in crisis because its dollar hegemony is in major crisis and decline. It's collapsing right before our eyes as the euro flexes its muscle and is now over 20% appreciated above the dollar. The U.S., just like Britain, on the eve of the British jumping into war in World War I, was financially bankrupt. So it used its military might to try to forestall its collapse and to try to capture premium hydrocarbon reserves throughout the planet to try to rebuttress its financial economic institutions. The U.S. dollar is tied within the petrodollar scheme, and as more and more countries are turning away or from the grips of the U.S., in part because just its debt is so enormous, and so many countries are finding it impossible to consume its debt, that has caused so much global instability, global debt, especially in the third world, global recession, that the conflict that it is causing and the chaos it's causing has put the whole global privatized financial structure out of complete balance. Now you have a realignment since the collapse of the Soviets, and more countries are trying to gain certain amount of independence, the same type of independence that Brzezinski in his grand chessboard talked about striking down. They're the same type of independence and connections and collaboration within the Middle East that Carter, in his Carter Doctrine, spoke against and said that the U.S. empire is willing to use violence, if necessary, to preserve its interests. The same type of developments that the neocons, in other words, it has nothing to do with a particular Democrat, Republican, or a particular administrator or group of people or bodies involved within this particular privatized sphere, imperial sphere at the time. It has to do with the fact that the empire is predicated on global hegemony dominance, especially on its a crucial dollarism pillar that is now in a free fall. Within that context, the Democrats are doing what they're supposed to do, which is trying to protect the empire, which is projecting out and help facilitating imperial attacks, imperial war, internally and externally. The imperial aspect is the disciplining that must take place for those in power within this society who see a situation where within the near future, permanent wars are going to be taking place on a geographic scale for world contest and dominance. And what one needs to do if one is an imperialist, whether they have a Democrat stamped on their head or a Republican an R stamped on their head is they must discipline their particular society into a war command society. That's in part what's going on. On the slave plantation, you had slaves who were whipped by the slave master and or the slave master's foreman. You know, Clarence Thomas and those types would do the whipping for a slave master also. Now, this wasn't just out of some kind of bizarre, sick, sadistic type of bloodlust. There was a method to this barbaric madness, and it was to condition and discipline the slaves to into a relationship with the slave masters and the slaves and within the society to basically be conditioned into a slave society, which the slave masters and those who were a part of it planned on having a slave society indefinitely, a permanent slave society. So there are various things you do to that population to condition physically and psychologically to those slaves. Within the present context of where the U.S. empire is now, with its conflicts with China on a geopolitical, geographic, currency, and resource war scales, with Russia, with Iran, with Colombia, etc., or with Venezuela, they find themselves in a situation where they see in the near future intensified conflict and wars. So they are conditioning with these draconian laws a war command society. These draconian laws are not just draconian laws just to be draconian, or fascistic laws just to be fascistic. These cats and the Democrats, Republicans, all this stuff that is happening, these indefinite incarcerations, the suspension of various forms of people's rights and stuff like that, is all part of creating and restructuring the society and the people within it into a war command society. In the same way that their job was to condition black folks into a slave command society. That's what's taking place. And since the Democrats are as deeply dedicated in maintaining the U.S. as the world imperial hegemonic power on the planet, the Democratic Party is also engaged in that process. For they see and understand the continuous war that Sam is going to be engaged in the foreseeable future. Columbia, Washington's Other Oil War, by Dorian Ferti. It goes like this. Almost 5 years ago, and countless thousands of people dead and disappeared, the U.S. 7.5 billion initiative, known as Plan Columbia, has failed, politically and militarily, to bring an end to the crisis that characterizes the violence-ridden South American country of Colombia. Begun in 2000, Plan Colombia was ostensibly designed to take the, quote, war on drugs to the drug producers. The U.S. argued these were preliminary, quote, primarily, quote, narco-terrorists, unquote, the Marxist guerrillas of the Revolutionary Armed Force of Colombia, FARC, and the Smaller Army of National Liberation, ELN, as well as the right-wing paramilitaries, the so-called United Self-Defense Forces of Colombia. However, the U.S. has had other motives. While most of the country has not been explored for oil, Colombia is already the third largest exporter in Latin America after Venezuela and Mexico. The industry accounts for one-third of Colombia's exports, and most of Colombia's oil exports are to the U.S. Colombia sits on the Venezuela-Orinoco Belt, the planet's largest accumulation of hydrocarbons, which it shared with Venezuela and Ecuador. However, the latter two countries, like most of South America, are part of a left-wing revolt against Washington's neoliberal policies. In Ecuador, a popular uprising just overthrew one president seen as too close to Washington. In Venezuela, the Bolivarian Revolution, led by Hugo Chavez, has reasserted popular control over the country's oil reserves and used the revenue to benefit the poor majority. Washington has responded to such anti-capitalist behavior with support for an unsuccessful coup, an attempted shutdown on the oil industry, and a relentless propaganda campaign against Chavez, all with little effect. The situation makes securing Colombian oil a priority for the U.S. U.S. military expenditure and training is in fact concentrated in the oil-rich areas of Colombia, particularly Acre and Putumayo, which are in the guerrilla heartland. A key part of the International Monetary Fund, IMF, restructures connected to Plan Colombia has been changes to the oil industry. The government oil company Ecopetrol has been essentially privatized to encourage, quote-unquote, foreign investment in the oil industry. Royalties have been cut to 8%, leases extended indefinitely, and the Colombian government now buys its own oil from foreign companies such as California-based Occidental Petroleum at market rates. Colombia also remains important to the U.S. as a counterweight to the growth of left-wing anti-imperialist governments and movements throughout South America, which are threatening Washington's interests. Plan Colombia, due to expire this year, has made Colombia the third largest recipient of U.S. military assistance after Israel and Egypt, receiving $3 million per day in military aid. 80% of Plan Colombia has come in the form of military funding. The initial draft of Plan Colombia called for $1.3 billion from the U.S. and $4 billion from the Colombian government. Then, in recession, much of the final $7.5 billion funding was therefore supplied by loans from the IMF, which have demanded a series of structural reforms to the Colombian economy. European countries, which initially while initially supportive, pulled out because of the excessive military focus, with the exception of Spain and Britain. In April 2001, when U.S. President George Bush established the Adrian Regional Initiative, a $1.1 billion regional expansion of Plan Colombia into Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia, Venezuela, Brazil, and Panama, 54% of the funds were spent on military aid. Since 2003, U.S. military expenditure in Colombia has been more than $500 million annually and has totaled more than $3 billion since 2000. A bill is currently before the U.S. Congress requesting another $741.7 million for 2006. With U.S. training, two-thirds of the Colombian Army are now involved in protecting the oil-rich sectors of the country. Under U.S. supervision, the Colombian military recently launched Operation Shield, quote-unquote, a new attempt to secure oil pipelines, to which the U.S. has donated 10 Huey and Black Hawk helicopters. A new counter-guerrilla unit has been created especially to police the Cano Lyman oil fields in Acre near the Venezuelan border, which some fear could become a base for aggression against Venezuela. Let me stop right there. Now, as I've gone into on the last Dollars and Chains 2, where all of these different places throughout the world where there are large hydrocarbon reserves, the U.S. is either setting up bases or counterinsurgency or units of military units to basically try to dominate these particular regions. Once again, in Colombia, we see the same thing taking place. Now here, another aspect. Here, Colombia is third as far as receiving military funding behind Israel and Egypt. See, what this is about is resources, geopolitical and geographic imperial strategies to maintain control and domination over important energy resource systems, and that in part for the U.S. especially helps buttress up and maintain its control over its domination in the world currency. because the petrodollar, the U.S. dollar, is tied to the hydrocarbon systems, as I've gone over in earlier series and stuff. So you can see the situation. The Colombian government doesn't even need any real serious lobbyist groups. You know, it's not about the lobbyist that is facilitating all of this money into Colombia. It's about U.S. Strategic interests. That's the real world, and that's how all of this stuff really works. Even though 60% of the Colombian people live in dire poverty, does that matter to the U.S. empire? No, because the masses of people do not matter to the U.S. empire. This is about global domination and control. It doesn't matter to the empire. It doesn't matter to Boy George. It doesn't matter to the Democrats, because the masses of us, the slaves, the servants on the planet, do not matter to these barbarians. This is the real world, and this is what's going on this planet today, as they are intensifying the domination on the planet and ratcheting up more and more intensified wars, even wars that you don't really hear about too much, because we are in a current state of permanent war. And what is being done in part is a situation where they are passing laws within this society to help facilitate a command war society. They're just not abstract laws, you know, trying to be fascistic just to be fascistic. In other words, there's two things that Boy George has said that should be noted. At one time, he said that he's the war president. And, you know, people laugh, you know, and other people say, oh, yeah, you know, he's, you know, the commander in chief, and he sees himself as the war president, you know, and the war on terror and all this rhetoric. And then he's also said that he wouldn't mind seeing a dictatorship as long as he's the dictator. Now, if you take these two different things that he said at two different times, they weren't at the same time, but you'll see that basically he's saying that it would be easier for him as the war president, which he sees himself as, to facilitate his war policies if he had dictatorial powers. So when you see these types of policies following through, you basically see a society that has come, an elite, an order within a society that sees the efficiency for the current state of affairs that it is in, the crisis that it is in, to have a war command society, i.e. a dictatorial type of society that is in the war mode. Now next, Scahill talks about the Democrats' behavior at their convention center in 2004 to give some more insight on this. Check this.
I was there in Boston in 2004 at the Democratic National Convention when the Democrats had demonstrators who were against the war relegated to a protest tent which wasn't even didn't even have a clear sight, a vision to the convention center. Barbed wire at the top of this massive fence so that no one could hurl objects. The soldiers, not police, the soldiers who were protecting the Democrats told us. What happened to Posse Comitatus in this country? The provision banning the military from patrolling our streets and being engaged in domestic law enforcement activities. Yeah, the Democrats had soldiers outside the convention center, and they had a protest pen that one federal judge referred to as an internment camp to keep protesters in. 9 out of 10 Democrats to the DNC, according to several polls, were against the war, and yet you wouldn't have known that it was the Democratic Party convention if you watched the speeches given from the podium. When John Kerry said John Kerry reporting for duty and called for a doubling, as John Edwards did, of U.S. Special Forces in Iraq, some anti-war campaign that was. All five of the major Democratic Party candidates for president in 2004 are pro-war individuals. Howard Dean never met a war he didn't adore until he realized that he could tap in to the good nature and goodwill of ordinary Americans who wanted to say no to this war. Howard Dean criticized John Kerry for supporting the Gulf, for being against the Gulf War. Howard Dean supported the bombing of Yugoslavia. Howard Dean supported the occupation of Afghanistan. Howard Dean said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Who lied to Howard Dean? He wasn't in Congress. He didn't have access to intelligence reports. When I confronted Howard Dean on the campaign trail in New Hampshire, I said, Governor Dean, why did you say that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction? He said, I guess I was wrong. Probably not a good time to talk about this. And I pressed ahead and I said, who told you? Who gave you this information? And unlike John Kerry and John Edwards and all of these other pro-war Democrats, Howard Dean didn't use the excuse of Bush misled us. Howard Dean told me I was given that information by senior people within the Clinton administration. Sounds like Howard Dean was misled by the Democrats. So we had General Wesley Clark, a war criminal who belongs in The Hague with all the Serbs and Croats and Bosnian Muslims. Joe Lieberman, I don't know why Lieberman didn't just run as a Republican to try to challenge George Bush. You know, John Edwards now, he's hoodwinking people left and right now. He's running this populist Bobby Kennedy imitation thing, running around the country, you know, and it's great. It sounds great, John Edwards. But when it actually mattered, when he had a voice, where was he? He was a vegetarian between meals. John Edwards was voting for the Patriot Act. John Edwards was voting for the war. Oh, but now he realizes that the majority of you and the majority of everyone outside of this church tonight is against the war. So John Edwards now, oh, he's against the war. Where were you when it mattered? You were right there alongside George W. Bush. No, it's not that the Democrats have no spine. It's that their spine is firmly in line with Bush's. Such is the state of our democracy today that even the good-natured people that are in this church tonight have that perennial problem of the hopelessness of the Democratic vote. And so we face the reality that unless the Democrats stand up and stop this filthy war, it will remain theirs until every single U.S. soldier is back here. This is the Democrats' war as much as it is Bush's war. There are sins of omission and sins of commission, and the Democrats are guilty of both. You know, there's also an incredible amount of historical revisionism in the times that we're living in. You know, the Bush administration has taken 9/11 and manipulated it to give them...
Helen.
So here you have a situation where, of course, it's the Democrats' war just as much as the Republicans. But that's because the interest that they serve at the end of the day is part of a ruling order that is for empire, which is for dollarism, which is for the petrodollar system, exchange system, and the maintenance of that, and it's for and tied to that, one has to have, the empire must have, an incredible imperial military machine. You can't have one without the other, because you have to condition and beat down the world population when necessary to maintain your particular quote-unquote interest. The Democrats are just as dedicated to that. That's why they're just as dedicated to the IMF, World Bank, structural adjustment policies, and all of these other things that are pulverizing the planet. And the dollarism system is a part of that. So it is no surprise when the Democrats have some little military G.I. Joes patrol around the Democratic convention and stuff, because in part that's where all of this type of militarization of the planet internally and externally is headed. Peter Del Scott wrote a news analysis commentary called Homeland Security Contracts for Vast New Detention Camps. It goes something like this. Quote, a Halliburton subsidiary has just received a $385 million contract from the Department of Homeland Security to provide, quote, temporary detention and processing capabilities, unquote. The contract announced January 24th by the engineering and construction firm KBR calls for preparing for, quote, an emergency influx of immigrants or to support the rapid development of new programs, unquote, in the event of other emergencies such as a natural disaster, quote unquote. The release offered no details about where Halliburton was to build these facilities or when. To date, some newspapers have worried that open-ended provisions in the contract could lead to cost overruns. That's what they're worried about. Such as having occurred with KBR in Iraq. A Homeland Security spokesperson has responded that this is a, quote, contingency contract, unquote, and that conceivably no centers might be built. But almost no paper so far has discussed the possibility that detention centers could be used to detain American citizens if the Bush administration were to declare martial law. For those who follow covert government operations abroad and at home, the contract evoked ominous memories of Oliver North's controversial Rex 84, a readiness exercise, quote-unquote, in 1984. This called for the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, to round up and detain 400,000 imaginary refugees, quote-unquote, refugees. In the context of, quote, uncontrolled population movements, unquote, over the Mexican border into the United States, North's activities raised civil liberty concerns in both Congress and the Justice Department. The concern persists. Quote, almost certainly, this is in preparation for a roundup after the next 9/11 for Mideasterners, Muslims, and possibly dissenters, unquote, says Daniel Ellsberg, a former military analyst who in 1971 released the Pentagon Papers, the U.S. military account of its activities in Vietnam. Quote, they've already done this on a smaller scale with the special registration, quote-unquote, detention of immigrant men from Muslim countries and with Guantanamo, unquote. Plans for detention facilities or camps have a long history going back to fears in the 1970s of a national uprising by black militants. As Alonzo Chardy reported in the Miami Herald on July 5, 1987, an executive order for continuity of government, CAG, had been drafted in 1982 by FEMA head Luis Garifia. The order called for, quote, suspension of the Constitution and declaration of martial law, unquote. The martial law portions of the plan were outlined in a memo by Guliafa deputy John Brinkerhoff. Let me stop right there. Now, we've gone over this in detail in the Hurricane Sam series number 4, FEMA, The Beast Is Landed, when I detail all of the psyops, all of the sabotage that FEMA is doing and has done in the past, the secret money that it sets aside to create bunkers and all of these types of things, how they're not really a rescue, quote-unquote, operation. They're there for maintenance of the empire. They're there for the beast apparatus and its tentacles to operate as it helps unleash them on the public and stuff. So what you see going on that is taking place right through Democratic administrations, Republican administrations, is the facilitation of this process. Administration after administration. And now with the current crisis, global crisis, and strategic type of grand chessboard strategizing that one sees going on, and with the empire in a mode of perpetual permanent war, it is also with its facilitators, the Democrats and Republicans, militarizing and projecting and reorganizing this society into a more permanent war command society. These Patriot Acts, and before that, the anti-terrorism bills and all of that, that crime bill passed, these aren't just abstract laws or draconian laws just to be draconian. It's to condition the population into the mode that the empire is in. This is something that they've historically always done. Just think of it in the context of when they've always want, this has always been a consumer or a consumer society. So they try to condition the population into, of course, a consumer mode with commercials, with the whole type of, you know, this style is in, that style is out, you know, all that type of gumpification process to get people into a psychology and into a whole way of life that is very disposable and is always predicated on spending and consuming more and more. Well, within that context, this society has other modes that it operates in and sees necessary for the perpetuation and maintenance of its empire. And the mode I see it in now is a war command mode because of the projection of permanent wars throughout the planet that it is intensifying as it finds itself in dollar crisis, one of its major pillars of empire. Now, here Helen Thomas asked Boy George about why he really went to war. Let's check out Boy's response. Dig this.
After that brilliant performance at the Gridiron, I am...
Sorry.
Well, then let me take it back.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. President, your decision to invade Iraq has caused the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis, wounds of Americans and Iraqis for a lifetime. Every reason given, publicly at least, has turned out not to be true. My question is, why did you really want to go to war? Mm-hmm. From the moment you stepped into the White House, from your cabinet form of cabinet officers, intelligence people, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What was your real reason? You have said it wasn't oil, quest for oil. It hasn't been Israel or anything else. What was it?
Yeah, I think your premise, and all due respect to your question and to you as a lifelong journalist, is that, you know, I didn't want war. To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen, in all due respect. No, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true. My attitude about the defense of this country changed on September the 11th. When we got attacked, I vowed then and there to use every asset at my disposal to protect the American people. Our foreign policy changed on that day, Helen. You know, we used to think we were secure because of oceans and previous diplomacy, but we realized on September 11, 2001, that killers could destroy innocent life. And I'm never going to forget it. And I'm never going to forget the vow I made to the American people that we will do everything in our power to protect our people. Part of that meant to make sure that we didn't allow people to provide safe haven to an enemy, and that's why I went into Iraq. Hold on for a second. Excuse me for a second, please. Excuse me for a second. They did. The Taliban provided safe haven for Al-Qaeda. That's where Al-Qaeda trained and... Afghanistan provided safe haven for Al-Qaeda. That's where they trained. That's where they plotted. That's where they planned the attack that killed thousands of innocent Americans. I also saw a threat in Iraq. I was hoping to solve this problem diplomatically. That's why I went to the Security Council. That's why it was important to pass 1441, which was unanimously passed. And the world said, disarm, disclose, or face serious consequences. And therefore, we worked with the world. We worked to make sure that Saddam Hussein heard the message of the world. And when he chose to deny inspectors, when he chose not to disclose, then I had the difficult decision to make to remove him. And we did. And the world is safer for it.
So you can hear Boy George stumbling over his lies, just throwing anything out there. We all know, and it's all been on record, that it was Crime Bill Clinton who pulled the inspectors out. And as I've detailed in Dollars for Change series, basically they saw a situation where they weren't going to release Saddam from the grips of those devastating sanctions that took over a million people's lives. At least 500,000 of those were kids. And part of it was for geostrategic hydrocarbon resource, meaning petrodollar resource reasons. You had a situation where Saddam basically had contracts with China, with France, with countries outside of the U.S. and Britain, except for one small British petroleum company. It wasn't British Petroleum. So here, all the contracts, once the sanctions were lifted, were not going to go to the U.S. Saddam, on September 24th, 2000, announced that he was going over to the euro currency. So anyone buying petroleum from him in the oil for food exchange would have to buy it in euro currency. He was pumping out 3.3 million barrels of petroleum per day. Sam was buying 60% of it. So Sam was buying 2.5 million barrels of petroleum per day. Sam had to buy that petroleum in euros. When Saddam first started it, he announced it in September 24th of 2000. The program got started in November of 2000. During that time, when it first got started, the euro was depreciated below the dollar. By the time Sam invaded in March of 2003, the euro had appreciated above the US dollar by 17%. So the whole world was checking out how much the euro had appreciated above the dollar. And now it's over 20% above the dollar in appreciation. The dollar is tumbling and in a quagmire crisis. So U.S. corporations had to convert their U.S. dollars into euros to buy, which was appreciated above the U.S. dollars, to buy 2.5 million barrels of petroleum today. And they all knew that once the sanctions were lifted, the contracts were going elsewhere. Now, throughout the world, many countries are talking about the real crises that the U.S. dollar is in. Now, the Gumpified War Command media is not going to emphasize on these types of things. They're going to more or less allow Boy George to lie and say that we passed 1441 and the world is safer for after removing Saddam and all of this type of stuff, trip up on his own words about we won't allow people to keep a safe haven for our enemies, and that's why we went into Iraq. You know, and then later in that same conversation goes, the Taliban provided a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. So he's so silly that he can't even get his whole mind straight on how to try to manipulate people. But he doesn't have to, because as noted in other commentaries, as noted in other articles, they had already planned to go into Iraq, as documents have shown, long before any of this 9-1-1 type of stuff. And the only reason why they latched on to the weapons of mass destruction is because that was what the American public was biting into. So they just went with it. So this is the real world that's going on. While he's trying to keep people in a perpetual state of, I'm the war commander, I'm going to keep you safe, we're in a state of war, and all of that type of stuff. In Asia, an East Asian economist paper came out talking about Asia must prepare for dollar's collapse. It goes, quote, the warning comes as the U.S. trade deficit reaches a record high and global interest rates continue to rise. Mashar Al-Khawi, the ADB head of regional economic integration, said on Tuesday, quote, any shock hitting the U.S. economy or the global market may change investors' perception given the existing global current account imbalance. Quote, our suggestion to Asian countries is don't take this continuous financing of the U.S. current account deficit as a given. If something happens, then East Asian economies have to be prepared. He said, because of the highly independent nature of East Asian economies, if countries work together to allow their currencies to collectively appreciate against a tumbling dollar, then the cost of adjustments would be spread. So, once again, here you have people internationally openly talking about the real dynamics that they see unfolding. Now, I'm sure many people in Britain didn't realize the full magnitude of their economy's crisis on the eve of World War I. The British Empire still flexing its muscle. It went to war and flexed out its military might, but it was a bankrupt empire. So, its flexing of its muscle was in part because of its financial quagmire and weakening position in the world at that time. Now, let's check out Scahill and hear about the lawless use of weapons of mass destruction that Sam is using on the landscape of Iraq and other crimes that this criminal is engaged in. Check this out.
Illegal weapons, cluster bombs, uranium munitions, otherwise known as depleted uranium or DU, and white phosphorus are being used in Iraq. Fuel air bombs have been used, all of which are gross violations of international law. Protocol 1, Section 1 of the Geneva Convention applies to the methods and means of warfare. In Article 35 of such states, quote, in any armed conflict, the right of the parties to the conflict to choose methods or means of warfare is not unlimited. It is prohibited to employ weapons, projectiles, and material and methods of warfare of a nature to cause superfluous injury or unnecessary suffering. White phosphorus is an incendiary weapon that is exposed to the skin, and the proper methods of extinguishing it are not applied, which to a civilian population, there's really no such thing as a proper method of extinguishing it, will burn all the way down to the bone. It's safe to say that this type of weapon causes superfluous injury and unnecessary suffering. The white phosphorus story I want to talk about, flesh it out a little bit more, because it's very interesting, and it's just one small example of how much is going on in Iraq and what happens when you catch one of these things, one of these violations of international law going on. The second siege of Fallujah was launched on November 8, 04, and I covered it. I wasn't able to get into the city because of the draconian security measures I mentioned. I know of one other Western reporter that's actually made it into that city since the siege. So I covered the siege by interviewing refugees. Hundreds of thousands of people fled Fallujah, and they were coming mostly to Baghdad. And so I interviewed refugees coming out of the city at different times from different areas of the city, and doctors. I even made it to some of the nearby smaller cities on the outskirts of Fallujah a couple of times to interview doctors there. And the consistent story that I was getting, in which I reported on Democracy Now! About 10 days, roughly 10 days into the siege, I believe it was November 18th, was that different people were all coming out and describing this weapon that was dropped, spreading fire everywhere, lots of smoke, and when it hit people's skin, it was impossible for them to put it out. It was caramelizing their skin. I talked to doctors that were saying, yes, this is definitely some sort of a chemical weapon or an incendiary weapon. I didn't know at the time to call it white phosphorus, but I just relayed on via Democracy Now! And writing a news story on it for Interpress Service that unusual, quote-unquote, unusual weapons were being used in Fallujah, describing it very vividly. It, of course, sounded like some sort of a napalm-type incendiary weapon. So this was, of course, reported on Democracy Now! And it's a press service on the Internet, but no mention of it whatsoever, of course, in the mainstream corporate media. And then flash forward to, I think it was around November or October or so, this past October, when Rai Television in Italy ran a documentary about Fallujah, specifically reopening the door of illegal weapons being used, and they alleged chemical weapons which of course white phosphorus is classified as a chemical weapon, a chemical incendiary weapon. And that reopened the door on the story. And so what happened was the Independent in the UK, the Independent newspaper, really went after the Pentagon on this. They had the facts, and they started writing stories, and they had me rewrite some of my information that I had put out basically a year prior to this about these weapons. And the Pentagon's initial reaction was flat-out denial. No illegal weapons were used, no incendiary weapons, none of this stuff. And then more evidence was produced, and then the Pentagon spokesperson said, well, okay, we do use white phosphorus, but only for illumination purposes, because it burns extremely brightly. Well, the Independent stayed on it. We produced more information, found some soldiers to come out talking about white phosphorus was used. We call it whiskey peat over the radio. I listened to the radio. I saw the charred bodies. I had stepped over charred bodies on the ground. So then the Pentagon spokesperson came out and said, well, yes, we did use white phosphorus in Fallujah, but only against, quote-unquote, insurgents. And then more information was produced. A field manual was produced with soldiers talking about, you know, writing very specifically about using white phosphorus. I mean, basically enough evidence that the Pentagon was screwed. There was no way they could deny all of this. So they essentially then came out and said, okay, we did use white phosphorus, but specifically against fighters, and maybe some did hit some of the civilian population. And then a week or two passed, the story basically died down some. And then essentially they went out of their way, the Pentagon went out of their way to state that, yes, we will continue to use white phosphorus in Iraq when necessary. Of course, it is a violation of international law.
But international law and national quote-unquote law does not mean nothing to this ruthless empire. And in the war mode that it is in, you can see that it has already conditioned much of its population not to even flex, not to even flinch at these types of obvious hypocritical things that are taking place within the global sphere, under the boots of Sam. Sam goes into Iraq under the pretext of WMDs. Sam's the one who uses cluster bombs, depleted uranium, fuel air bombs, white phosphorus. In other words, weapons of mass destruction. But already, much of the American population is in this war command mode on a psychological level, which is exactly where they want the population. And it's O'Reilly and them's job to condition further the population and to regiment the media to even be more in a command militarized media network dissemination military propaganda machine. All of these attacks on professors and stuff like that, that's just not abstract things or just totalitarian type things. This is a empire in a command war mode. And in that situation, war is what they want made easy. Now also, let's check out here Senator Pat Roberts on Wolf Blitzer talking about domestic spying that Boy George's administration has been engaged in. And let's see how he frames it within this war command mode society that we've been talking about. Dig this.
Let's talk about domestic surveillance without warrants. Listen to what the vice president said this week.
Some Democrats in Congress have decided that the president is the enemy and that the terrorist surveillance program is grounds for censuring the president.
As the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, you've been severely criticized, as you know, by other Democratic members of your own committee, Democrats in general, for refusing to hold those kinds of hearings that they want, the kind of hearings that Senator Spector, for example, had in the Judiciary Committee. What do you say to the critics who say you're not going far enough to investigate this whole surveillance without warrants?
Basically, let's start off. This is the highest classified program we have. And I am literally amazed. I think it's remarkable where some of the major media, i.e. the New York Times, decides to release this story, which is wrong on its face. A lot of wrong information. A cascade of misinformation that this is domestic spying and we're spying on Aunt Harriet, so on and so forth. We have a capability. It is a unique capability. It is very difficult to fit this capability into the FISA court system. That almost can't be done. And then we also have a new threat, or a different kind of threat, in regards to terrorism. It is within the constitutional authority of the President of the United States to protect us from possible terrorist attacks. Now, we do have Al-Qaeda in the country. We do have sleeper cells. We do have plots. The reason I know is because I've been briefed on the program. But my real dilemma is I can't tell you what the operational details are. That was limited to the four members of the leadership. We have increased it from two, from five to seven. Staff's in the room. Staff has been briefed. They have been briefed. They've gone out to the NSA. I've gone out to the NSA. I think the program is lawful. I think it's essential. And the biggest thing is that it works. And if we don't get this off the headlines and quit talking about it, we will lose the capability and America will be less safe. And this isn't a Bush issue. This is an issue for the next commander-in-chief to have the authority, and the one after that, to have the authority to protect the country. I know people worry about our civil liberties. I'm an old newspaper guy. I worry about them. But you don't have any civil liberties if you're dead.
Now, some of that was quite instructive, even though I don't think he planned on it being that instructive. When you hear him say that, this isn't about Bush. This is for the next commander-in-chief and the next one after that. See, what he's basically saying is perpetual war. And within that, he also said that the Constitution gives the authority for the president to protect us. But he's just justifying this domestic spying network within the concept of a president protecting us. But we're not supposed to know exactly what they're doing for our own protection. You know, cats like him are supposed to know. We're just supposed to believe them. So protecting us means spying on us. That's what he's saying. For our own protection. And it's permanent. Because it's not just for Boy George, it's for the next commander-in-chief and the next one. See, this is what I mean by the permanent war. And what they're doing is not just an external thing. And it's not just some power grab by a bunch of rabid dogs. It is a power grab by rabid dogs, but it's for a particular conditioning and reason, and that is the reorganization of the society into a permanent war society because of the overall situations that this empire finds itself in on a geopolitical economic grand chessboard scale at this time. So he throws out the same type of so-called scare tactics that Boy does. We do have people plotting against us. Al-Qaeda's in here, sleeper cells, etc. But you know, you can't know this. You can't know the details and all of that type of stuff. Just people within the particular cabal. At the same time, as I went over with the whole FEMA stuff, they got all of these plans and detention centers, money for them to be built up. They have on the documents from the Patriot Act to FEMA's particular outlines, the various martial law and suspensions of the Constitution. Now, we've seen firsthand what these martial law things do in the real world to our rights. New Orleans. All one has to do is take an honest look at what has gone down over there. So this is part of the militarization of the society as a war command society. The secret meetings that Boy George has been having with reporters, with an agreement that this stuff is off the record, so that Boy George doesn't have to worry that these reporters won't be reporting it to the public. That ties into the embedded reporters, who are embedded with what? The military. So the media figures are part of a militarized command network system. It's all part of the militarization of the society as part of a war command society. Now, let's check out Scahill as he talks about the media, the corporate media in Iraq. No, wait, let's deal with the one that goes with Scahill talking about the media in Iraq under Sam's gun, being attacked by Sam. So let's see what type of media is acceptable and what type isn't.
We'll say this about the Bush administration. No president in the history of this country has waged a bloodier war on journalism and journalists than the regime of George W. Bush. Some 60 journalists have been killed in Iraq since the launch of the so-called War on Terror. More than 20 other media workers have been killed as well, making it well over 80 media workers that have been killed in Iraq. At least 13 of these journalists have been killed by U.S. forces in Iraq. The process of embedding that this administration, that the Pentagon has really perfected, has created, it's made a linchpin for the administration's successful propaganda campaign, and it's also made the world much more dangerous for journalists. Because what they've done is they have formalized the relationship that we've all seen for so many years between the corporate journalists and the Pentagon. So now you no longer have a need to really interview military spokespeople on CNN. You can just talk to Barbara Starr, the CNN Pentagon correspondent, because she basically is like a spokesperson for the Pentagon. And if that's not enough, you can just go over to CNN analyst Victoria Clark. Or is she the Pentagon spokesperson? Or is she both? Victoria Clark, at the beginning of Shock and Awe, was the Pentagon spokesperson. Now she's a paid analyst on CNN. But her message has remained the same through both jobs. She was the one who, on the eve of the U.S. invasion of Iraq, issued an ominous warning to unembedded journalists who were in Baghdad. She said, "Baghdad is a dangerous place. You should not be there." It was taken by unembedded journalists as a direct threat to their safety, one that would become realized all too quickly as the invasion began. The message was that if you are not with us in your camouflage, in your flak jacket, some journalists even carry guns. If you're not with us, you are with Saddam and the terrorists. That was their word for the Iraqi people, terrorists. And so what did they do? They waged war on those unembedded journalists. On the morning of April 8th, Tahar Kayyub, the Al Jazeera correspondent in Baghdad, was reporting all throughout the day from the roof of Al Jazeera's building. And I've been there many times in my time in Baghdad, which is right on the banks of the Tigris River. And Al Jazeera was in a very strategic position to see fierce battles between the U.S. and the last holdouts of Saddam's Revolutionary Guard at one of the palaces on the banks of the Tigris. And so Al Jazeera's correspondent, Tahar Kayyub, was reporting around the clock. And if any of you saw Control Room, you know a bit about the story that I'm telling here. Tahar Kayyub reporting through the day, and the United States was outraged at the report that he was giving, because he was essentially giving a play-by-play that the rest of the world didn't even have, and was showing the realness of the battle that was going on. And when Tahar Kayyub went up to the roof to adjust the camera angle, a U.S. warplane swooped in and bombed the office of Al Jazeera and killed Tahar Kayyub. Later on that day, a U.S. tank shelled the Palestine Hotel, where the U.S. military knew there were more than 100 international journalists unembedded. And that missile directly hit the Reuters office, where Reuters had a camera set up that was able to pan across the skyline of Baghdad. And when the missile hit that room on the 16th floor of the Palestine Hotel, it killed Spanish cameraman Jose Cuso and a Ukrainian cameraman for Reuters. Three journalists killed in a span of hours that were unembedded. The U.S. a few days earlier had shelled the Sheraton Hotel in Basra in the south of Iraq. Guess who the only guests at that hotel were? The Al Jazeera correspondents. The only guests there. In Afghanistan, they bombed Al Jazeera's offices as well. They also hit the offices of the BBC. All the while, they say that these are accidents or justified killings. Justified, and when I say justified, this is from their reports on the incidents. They actually refer to them as justified killings, such as the case of a Reuters freelancer who happened to have committed the crime of following resistance fighters. And the U.S. military was quoted by the New York Times as saying that he shouldn't have been with the resistance fighters, and that's why he was killed. Mazen Dana, who was a cameraman for Reuters, had covered the slaughter in Palestine for many, many years and had managed to escape death. Well, he hadn't met the U.S. military, obviously, because when he went to the Abu Ghraib prison to cover an uprising that was happening there, the U.S. military shot him down and said they had mistaken his camera for a rocket-propelled grenade launcher, despite the fact that he was in a vehicle and a vest that clearly labeled him as a journalist. So the United States has waged this undeclared war, declared, if you interpret the words of Victoria Clark, on journalists. And the overwhelming majority of the journalist deaths in Iraq have been Arab journalists.
So once again, you can see the type of permanent war that Sam is playing in a ruthless fashion. He's conditioning people externally on how it's going to play out, this war, and how ruthlessly and aggressively it's going to go after anything that it sees as possibly a deterrent to its particular goals. And internally, how they try to chastise any elements that of the media that they see not towing the line as properly. As Robert said, who we just played before, how he was amazed that some New York Times released the material on domestic spying, even though they waited a year. And the only reason why it seems like they released it was because one of the persons who worked for them, who had left the Times, was going to write a book, and they knew that some of that stuff was going to come out. So they came out themselves after a year after the fact, and after Boy George had already started the program, who knows how deeply in. We know that a number of people have been classified and put on the list just because of their ethnic descent, their religious background, or their political posturing and positions in the world today. So internally and externally, as Skahill was pointing out about the attacks, the physical attacks that has been going on, and the connection and cross-pollination of the military and the corporate media system with people like Victoria Clark, a Pentagon spokesperson one day, now an analyst for CNN, making statement that Baghdad is a dangerous place and you should not be there, to real journalists who are not embedded. This is the way and the course of the empire in these particular times, especially as it's in the stage of its permanent war. Now, let's check out Dick, I Got Five on It, Cheney, Five Deferments, meaning being asked about some of his statements in the past, you know, being the U.S. G.I. Joes being greeted as great liberators and the resistance in his last throes. And then follow this up with a mix of the war command media talking heads spinning this quagmire into in Iraq into the construction of it being Bush-hating media that's reporting just basic things about everyday things that are going on. and then we'll follow it up with a reality check with Scahill on how the media is really operating in Iraq. Dig this.
Mr. Vice President, all along the government has been very optimistic. You remain optimistic, but I remember when you were saying we'd be greeted as liberators. You played down the insurgency 10 months ago. You said it was in its last throes. Do you believe that these optimistic statements may be one of the reasons that people seem to be more skeptical in this country about whether we ought to be in Iraq?
No, I think it has less to do with the statements we've made, which I think were basically accurate and reflect reality, than it does the fact that there's a constant sort of perception, if you will, that's created because what's newsworthy is the car bomb in Baghdad. It's not all the work that went on that day in 15 other provinces in terms of making progress towards rebuilding Iraq.
But here's my problem, and this is a serious problem. We saw it at the top of the show with what's-her-name, who was bantering with Bush, the older woman.
Helen Thomas.
Helen Thomas. I believe that there is a segment of the media trying to undermine the policy in Iraq for their own ideological purposes. It's no longer dissent. It's no longer skepticism. It's we want to undermine it. And that disturbs me. Do you see that?
I see that pretty much every day, that there is a group of people who are invested in America's defeat in one of the most important conflicts in our nation's history. And being invested in defeat as an American, I don't care if you're a reporter, a commentator, or a business person, how have we gotten to this point in this country?
Because of hatred, ideological hatred.
Yeah.
What concerns me is, and I do not put you, Alan, in this category, I actually think that there are some persons, including those in the news media, who would rather the United States lose a war than have history write that George W. Bush was a successful president.
Who would that be?
I think that's pretty bad.
Who?
The national NBC, NBC, CBS, CNN, that crowd.
But I love the fact that Jim's admitting that, in fact, ultimately, in the long run, just like with Germany and Japan, that our presence there will pay off, that it's worth doing. And I think the president has a big order to contradict what the mainstream media is doing. You know, my favorite problem here. But that's the reality. And that's why he needs to have these press conferences. He needs to be very clear, frankly, not too detailed, but give an overall picture that the mainstream media is not providing the average American.
From the University of Virginia, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Virginia Republican Senator George Allen. Senator, we heard the president yesterday talk about how things are going better in cities like Talifar than the media would have you believe. And lo and behold, out today comes a front page story in the Washington Post about how things really aren't that good in Talifar. What do you make of that?
I don't understand one thing. Why isn't the message of success on the economy, the message of success in Afghanistan and Iraq, why does it not seem to be getting out that much?
Well, there's several reasons. One reason is that the intensity of the hatred, and I use the word hatred advisedly, toward George W. Bush by Democrats and by some of the people in the media is just so intense and begins to have a kind of an effect that affects people who don't hate him. I think the 2000 election is still in the craw of many Democrats that can't accept this president as well.
I think what you see reflected in the polls is the daily drumbeat of the mainstream media telling us that we're losing a war that we're winning. It's as simple as that. Television works, and if you pound a message home enough, it sooner or later will show up in the polls.
Corey, that having been said, a great deal of American mainstream media is invested in the idea that this is a disaster, that it will bring down Bush, that it was a mistake at the beginning and a disaster for the Middle East. They are pushing that agenda, quite obviously, over and over again, to the exclusion of important stories like the book by George Asada, Saddam's general, like the Philippine, the documents released today, covered in the Weekly Standard about the Kuwaiti hostages, denied by Iraq, having even been there, but now revealed today to have been used as human shields by the Mattaza Hatter sons of Saddam. There's quite a lot not being covered because to cover it, and to cover it extensively, will not only support the Bush administration decision to go to war here, but make it appear as though one of the wisest he has made, and indeed, investment in the failure of this operation is what is bringing increased contempt for the American media across the land, except on the noisy left. And the noisy left doesn't win elections.
What? That many of the prisoners thanked George W. Bush for their liberation. And I went up and questioned John Burns later on about that, shortly thereafter. And I said, Mr. Burns, when you wrote that many of the prisoners at Abu Ghraib thanked George W. Bush for their liberation, and I pulled out my notepad and I said, how many of them did that? And he said, what are you talking about? I said, I just mean that you wrote that many of the prisoners thanked George W. Bush for their liberation. So there were estimates of 30 to 45,000 prisoners were released. So are we talking 20,000 of them said thank you to Bush or 10,000? You know, because I actually was there a lot longer than you, and I didn't hear one person say that. So I'm just wondering, when you say many, because it is the paper of record, are we talking like thousands here came up to you and said that? And so he and I got into this thing, and he's saying, are you saying that the Pulitzer Committee twice erred when they gave me journalism's highest prize? And I said, no, I'm just saying how many is many. It's just one word. I just want to know what you mean by many. But the point of this story is twofold. One is I wanted to tell you about Johnny Burns, because such is the state of reporting at the paper of record. And that's one example. You can replicate that hundreds upon thousands of times, and you have the lies of our times from the New York Times. There were so many times in conflict zones where I saw a reality on the ground and then read a totally different one from the people covering the same thing and the same scene as I was the very next day.
So as you can see once again with Scahill finishing it off, the real role of this whole media system and all of these little talking heads talking about how the corporate media, many of them are invested in seeing America's defeat and how many of them haven't gotten over the 2000 election. And you hear Hannity, a fool who was harping up the weapons of mass destruction hype pre the invasion into Iraq, talking to Novak, the leaker of information, a Valerie Plame, an agent of imperialism, as a payback for some of the people in Bush's administration for what they considered the undermining of their agenda when Valerie Plame's husband just basically told the truth about this whole uranium, Africa, Iraq question. This shows how they're trying to condition the population into accepting a program of permanent war, and a permanent war command society is what's necessary to facilitate this permanent war stage. And anyone who questions or shows any image that reflects something that goes outside of the sphere of the resistance being on the last thresholds, or G.I. Joes and the U.S. Empire being greeted as great liberators, and is subjected to the attacks of these barbarians. And for Cheney, I got five on it, Cheney, five deferments, say that that statement reflected reality. In the midst of all of this madness is an indication of how sick and removed that they want the population to be from their own reality and their own interests. So let's stay on this media thing for a second to help break down further how the corporate media is part of this whole apparatus of the military propaganda information command network, as they are instituting in this war command society. So here's Dar Jamil dealing with some of the cases he's experienced while he was unembedded as a journalist in Iraq. Dig this.
Really encapsulates all of what's going on with the torture set as far as medical complicity, when it happened, which was far, far before the Abu Ghraib scandal was initially broke at the end of April 04. This was an individual, his name Sadiq Zoman. He was 55 years old at the time when he was detained. Yes, he's a member of the Ba'ath Party. Nevertheless, everything I'm going to describe are, of course, violations of international law. He was detained from his home in Kirkuk in the middle of the night when he was there with his family by U.S. forces. This was in August 03. And he was held for a month, transferred around to several U.S. military detention facilities. And while he was in U.S. custody, something happened to him. He was dropped off after a month in their custody by U.S. forces at Salah Hadin Hospital, General Hospital in Tikrit. He was dropped off in a coma. And despite the fact that when he was detained, all of his identification papers and money and other things in the house were taken with him, the name on the medical report written by a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army named Michael C. Hodges, his name was switched around, and the report went into great specifics, and it said, well, he's in a coma, and here's why. He had a heat stroke, and that then degraded into a heart attack, and we did numerous drips and other medical procedures to try to revive him, but basically his prognosis is that this is a permanent situation. The medical report did not mention the fact that there was massive physical trauma on his body. The back of his head was bashed in. He had electrical point burn marks on the bottom of his feet and his genitals. He had lash and whip marks and bruises up and down his entire body. None of this whatsoever was mentioned in the report, thus showing very explicit medical complicity. I have a copy of the medical report written by Michael C. Hodges, and we have photographic and video evidence of all of this. This is one example that I came across early on, and when I came across this story, I actually wasn't writing for even a regular internet outlet at the time. And I sent it off to all of the major newspapers in the U.S. And I said, look, I'm not even interested in writing this story personally. Send one of your reporters to cover it. But this information needs to get out. And not one out of 150 responded, which leads me to talk briefly of media complicity. We have to remember that the Nuremberg Charter for Journalism, which was set up after Hitler Nazi propaganda and as a result of the Nuremberg trials, the Nuremberg Charter for Journalism and the UNESCO Charter for Journalism both have a primary a precedent, which is the primary responsibility of media in wartime is not to incite the public to violence. Now, looking at corporate media in the U.S. through that lens, look at the media coverage leading up to the invasion of Iraq, the invasion itself, and then this ongoing occupation. Outlets like CNN, Fox, and stenographers such as Thomas Friedman and Judith Miller of the New York Times, and talking heads such as Bill O'Reilly and Rush Limbaugh, are certainly guilty of inciting the public to violence and aiding and abetting in war crimes and crimes against humanity, for arguing for the U.S. to violate the law by invading Iraq and making all of the aforementioned crimes possible. Finally, the Iraq War, even according to the ever pliant Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, even on September 4th, in September of 2004, told the BBC even that the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq was an illegal act that contravened the UN Charter. An act, a war of aggression is the mother of all war crimes.
So once again, within that context, you can see how basically they're conditioning the corporate military media system is conditioning through its propaganda network in the same way that Pat Buchanan was advocating a number of shows ago on Slave that must be done for proper purposes, you know, buy off the media, plant stories in Iraq, all of this propaganda. O'Reilly, Hannity, and the rest of them are doing is to facilitate the to facilitate for the empire its perpetual war strategy. They're facilitators, propagandists, cheerleaders, and to condition the population in various misleading ways that this war is necessary, that this war is good, that this war is essential for the righteousness of humanity. These are barbarians, savages. Here, Jamil couldn't even get out the story to all of these little savages when he sent this case over this cat, Sadiq Zoman, who was brutalized by these savages in the U.S. military, violating UNESCO and Nuremberg charters. The corporate media in America is, doesn't matter, because this is a war mode that the empire is in. And all of these entities, Democrats, Republicans, the corporate media institutions, are all following suit because they know what's really at stake. Now here, Jamil deals with a timetable for the withdrawal from Iraq by the empire. Now we slaves know that in a permanent in the permanent war in geostrategic, geographic, petrodollar warfare that Sam's engaged in the real world, there is no withdrawal. Check it out.
Lining out, talking a little bit about U.S. plans in Iraq. I think this is very, very important information for people to know, people who were for the war, people who were against the war. I want to be very clear about why the Bush administration will not talk about a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. And the reason is because they have no plans whatsoever to ever totally withdraw from Iraq. Of course, they would like to lower the number of troops down to something like we see in Afghanistan to around 30,000. But I want to just give you evidence of what's happening on the ground as far as the U.S. military. What does a timetable for withdrawal look like? Is it really temporary? What are they doing there? First of all, I want to talk about the U.S. quote-unquote embassy that, as we speak, is under construction in the middle of Baghdad inside the so-called Green Zone. The contract for this embassy was given to an extremely corrupt Kuwait company, and the initial price of this quote-unquote embassy is $592 million, which we're paying for. And let me describe briefly this embassy, end quote. There's 21 buildings, walls reinforced 2.5 times normal standards to be able to withstand bombardment, and it's going to have room for over 1,000 quote-unquote government officials. There's a gym, swimming pool, barber and beauty shops, food court, and a commissary. There's a large-scale permanent concrete barracks for troops, a school, locker rooms, warehouse, a vehicle maintenance garage, and 6 apartment buildings that'll have 619 one-bedroom apartments. The site, when completed, it will be two-thirds the area of the National Mall in Washington, D.C. Unlike Iraq's infrastructure, which is in total shambles, this construction project is moving along right on time. And now, talk briefly about U.S. military bases in Iraq. There are several massive military bases in Iraq. And just to give you an idea of these, let me describe one in particular, Camp Anaconda in Balad, which is not too far outside of Baghdad. At this camp alone, there's 20,000 U.S. soldiers, less than 1,000 of whom ever leave the base, ever. There's 2 base exchanges there, with the latest high-tech gear like iPods and CDs and other electronics that soldiers can buy. And recently, one of the managers of one of the base exchanges was very happy to brag that he was selling 15 television sets a day to U.S. troops there. The plans for the air-conditioned troop quarters right now are for the future for them to run internet lines into each one, have overseas phone booths for them, and, of course, cable television. There's thousands of civilian contractors on this base alone, enough that they even have their own section, a little neighborhood called KBR Land. There's a hospital where over 400 surgeries a month are being performed on wounded U.S. soldiers. Air Force officials at this particular base are proud to announce that their runway was one of the busiest in the world. One of them even said, I don't know if this is true or not, but one of them was quoted as saying that it was second only to Chicago O'Hare. There's 250 aircraft based there, so on any given day, there's a F-16 flying out, maybe queued up. To take off will be an unmanned Predator drone with a couple of Hellfire missiles on it, followed by helicopters, followed by troop transport planes coming in or going. Meanwhile, inside the base, there's lavish meals actually being served by third country nationals, which is the TCN is the name given now for people, basically slave laborers, who are being imported from places like India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bangladesh to serve this food. Soldiers used to go into combat and into war zones, and they would, of course, lose weight. Now soldiers are gaining weight on these bases, because if they don't like these quite elaborate meals that they're being served, on this base alone, they can go to a Pizza Hut, a Popeyes, a Subway sandwich, or to the 24-hour Burger King, and then wash it down with a mocha from Starbucks. There's several other gigantic bases like Camp Anaconda. For example, Camp Victory near the Baghdad airport. When this is complete, it will be twice the size of Camp Bonsteel in Kosovo, which is currently one of the largest overseas bases built since Vietnam. There are at least four of these bases right now in Iraq under construction. So no timetable for the Bush administration to withdraw from Iraq. Why not? Even surprisingly reported in the New York Times on April 1903, this is just barely over a week after Baghdad fell, U.S. military officials said, quote, "There will probably never be an announcement of permanent stationing of troops in Iraq. Not permanent basing, but permanent access is all that is required." Permanent access. This was written into the Iraqi Constitution. Remember the referendum vote on October 15? It was written in, inserted this clause by U.S. Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, which basically says the U.S. does have permanent access to these bases in Iraq.
Because they plan on permanent war. And that's what this society is all about. That's what the empire is all about. That's why the dollar must fall. That's why there needs to be a global campaign against the dollar. Dump the dollar. Dump the greenback. Destroy the U.S. Incredible imperial pillar of world hegemony. Here you have a situation where Iraq can be turned into this complete utter chaos, utter destruction, and even more genocidal mode that it already is in. But that would be all right for Sam, as long as Sam has access to the resources in its geostrategic grand chessboard game that it's playing out. That's why it's putting out those permanent quote-unquote bases for its permanent occupation and permanent wars. That's why all this rhetoric about bring the troops home is this shallow. Because this is empire maintenance. This is nothing else but that. And it plans to win. You don't have thousands of civilian contractors, slave laborers from India, Nepal, on and on, Popeyes, Burger Kings, at a camp, Anaconda, 250 aircrafts at this facility, G.I. Joes, up to 20,000 in the facility alone, selling 15 TVs a day in any kind of temporary situation. U.S. embassies being built at $592 million. This is madness. But this is the mode that they're in. They plan on permanent war. Continuous war. And they see Iraq as one of the key players in it. The other day, it came out in a Deutsche Presse stating that Russia's oil pipeline to China, beyond doubt, Putin says. And it goes into the whole aspect of the Russians and the Chinese making a deal where major amounts of cubic meters of natural gas annually will be pumped to China from Russia's eastern and western Siberian region, an export of 60 to 80 billion cubic meters. These are all of the types of things that Sam has been trying to avoid happen and stop from happening, that are in development along with the major deals that China recently made with Iran that I went into last week. And these particular blocks that are forming that the grand chessboard strategists of all stripes in the imperial sphere are trying to resist. So we know what the strategy truly is in this dollar and chains empire global war, permanent war, as long as there's a permanent privatized market order. As Dar Jamil also continues on. Check.
Another clue. The 2002 National Security Strategy of the U.S. Quote, our forces will be strong enough to dissuade potential adversaries from pursuing a military buildup in hopes of surprising or equaling the power of the United States. To accomplish this, the U.S. will require bases and stations within and beyond Western Europe and Northeast Asia. End quote. U.S. policymakers have essentially replaced the Cold War with the long war for global hegemony, empire, and unchallenged military might. Here's another clue. According to the military document Joint Vision 2020, as in the year 2020, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff vision here is, quote, dedicated individuals and innovative organizations transforming the joint force of the 21st century to achieve full-spectrum dominance, that's in bold type, persuasive in peace, decisive in war, preeminent in any form of conflict. That last bit is in italics. So let me spell it out for you with their own words to conclude. From the Quadrennial Defense Review Report, released on February 6th of this year, there is a stated ambition to fight, quote, multiple overlapping wars, end quote, and to, quote, ensure that all major emerging powers are integrated as constructive actors and stakeholders into the international system, end quote. The report goes on to say that the U.S. will, quote, also seek to ensure that no foreign power can dictate terms of regional or global security. It will attempt to dissuade any military competitor from developing disruptive or other capabilities that could enable regional hegemony or hostile action against the U.S. or other friendly countries, and it will seek to deter aggression or coercion. Should deterrence fail, the U.S. would deny a hostile power its strategic and operational objectives, end quote. Through that lens, let's hear General Pace again. I'd say they are going well. I wouldn't put a great big smiley face on it, but I would say they are going very, very well from everything you look at.
This is the course of empire in its true form. This is how empires truly work. Permanent war for permanent dominance, for the permanent destruction of humankind. From the words that we've gone over in this series of Jimmy Carter, in his Carter Doctrine, in his threat of force for any elements challenging U.S. hegemony in the Middle East region, and in the reserves that we know exist in that region, to Brzezinski basically saying the same thing that you just heard outlined in the various Joint Vision 2020 strategy for full spectrum dominance, as outlined, as I have mentioned in the past, in Brzezinski's book, The Grand Chessboard, to the neocons. Basically what they are saying is for the maintenance of empire, the world must be bludgeoned under our boots, and those within our society must be part of a war command society. A major pillar of the U.S. empire is in crisis, and they mean by any means to maintain it. They know what it is. As Henry Kissinger once noted, quote, who controls the food supply controls the people. Who controls the energy can control whole continents. Who controls money can control the world. Unquote. Control and domination is all they're about. A game plan on Iran has just been released, which denounced a situation by Mr. Sowers, who elaborates on what the U.S. in the E3, those who are aligned with the U.S. in this particular matter, on how they could pulverize Iran. If Iran, and basically implement in the war that Sam wants with Iran. This is a war that started, a projection of war that Sam has been planning even before Iran announced any kind of, which they backed up off of now, any plan of an Iranian burst, i.e. an Iranian stock exchange for petro-euro currency. Some of the article goes like this. Quote, this week the fog of Anglo-American diplomacy on the Iranian nuclear question parted momentarily to give the world a rare glimpse of the drive to war that lies behind. On Wednesday, the Times of London reproduced a letter written last week by John Sowers, the British Foreign Office point man on Iran, to his counterparts in the United States, France, and Germany, outlining the line of action the four allies should follow in the United Nations Security Council. Stripped of the verbiage and the too clever strategizing on how to choreograph Russia and Chinese consent for sanctions and war, the main point in Mr. Sowers' letter is that the Iranians need to know that, quote, more serious measures, quote unquote, are likely from the Security Council than just a presidential statement. Mr. Sowers elaborates on what the E3 and U.S. have in mind. Quote, this means putting the Iran dossier onto a Chapter 12 basis. We may also need to remove one of Iran's arguments from the suspension called for is voluntary. We should do both by making the voluntary suspension a mandatory requirement to the Security Council in a resolution we would aim to adopt in, say, early May. Chapter 12 is that part of the UN Charter dealing with threats to international peace and security. Putting the Iran dossier on to a Chapter 12 basis would allow the Anglo-Americans to do two things. First, circumvent Iran's legal right to uranium enrichment as enshrined in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, its safeguards, agreements, its additional protocol, and in every additional resolution passed by the International Atomic Energy Agency Board of Governors on the Iranian issue. Secondly, generate a minimally plausible but absolutely essential legal fig leaf for military action against Iran in the likely event that the Iranians do not comply with such a Chapter 12 resolution. So far, the Russians and Chinese have made clear that they are not prepared to appease the Christmas in Tehran, quote-unquote, folks, in Washington and London, but in allowing the Iranian file to reach the Security Council, Moscow and Beijing have allowed the U.S. to ratchet up the rhetoric and pressure. This drive to penalize Iran in some way will become a test case for how seriously Russia and China and the world have learned the lessons of the 2003 invasion. Now, what we see in this, and the article goes longer, it's in The Hindu by Sidaris Vardhanajan, March 25th, 2006. It's called The Game Plan on Iran is Becoming Clear, about a document that was released recently that outlines that they have a global strategy of war, and what they're basically talking about is how to implement this war. They're not trying to do anything but implement the war. They want Iran to walk out by putting all of these types of things that would just basically frustrate the Iranians, so that then they'll just jump into their next stage. This is not Democrat. This is not Republican. This is empire in a stage of crisis. And a collaboration between two of the pillars of the global empires. The British alignment with the U.S. on the monetary scale, where Saudi Arabia, of course, fits in, is on the geographic hydrocarbon sphere, which helps it in its maintenance of its petrodollar resource system. These are all players within the empire sphere. And these are all players who are part of an order. And all those who play other games with and against them in a privatized mode that have to be removed from the scene. Hold on. These are not just arbitrary acts by the empire, internally or externally, but the restructuring of the American plantation and the planet for permanent war, and for us on the slave plantation in America, resistance on this war command society, if we are going to have any remnants of a society worth living in, is what we must fight against. Until the next time, slave out.